It's Ouch for May 2014. I'm Kate.
And I'm Rob. This month's show is all about inspiring people and without any running shoes or mountain climbing gear in sight.
Thank goodness. We have the story of a young single disabled woman, a full-time user of personal assistance, who's just adopted a 17-month-old disabled child. Hear her story in about 20 minutes.
And our citizen correspondents return to bring you news from often unheard corners of the disability universe. Find out what headlines they've got for us shortly.
And we liked the impromptu quiz so much last month, we brought it back. Don't go away now.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
And joining us throughout the show today, we have what can only be described as disability royalty in the form of Barbara Lisicki. Hello, Barbara.
Hello.
So now a disability equality trainer, you were one of the founder members of DAN, a direct action protest group which came to prominence in the 1990s before there were any anti-discrimination laws for disabled people. And these laws are going to be 20 years old next year. And you may remember, listeners, those famous pictures of disabled people chained to London buses all protesting about the accessibility of transport. We're going to chat about all that in a bit more detail later on. But as a teaser, people may not remember that DAN started because of outrage against a TV show. So can you tell us a little bit about that, Barbara?
Yeah, it was the ITV Telethon. It was the sort of independent television network's equivalent to the BBC's Children in Need, I suppose. But if I can say this, it was much worse. It was terrible. And
what do you mean terrible? And how long ago was this?
It ran every 2 years and it took up 23 hours of airtime on ITV.
And this was in the 90s or
it was
earlier?
In the late 80s and early 90s.
Okay.
And after it got to about the second or third one, disabled people started to say, why are we being exposed to and having to tolerate this unadulterated junk and this appalling representation?
What were they doing,
people?
Though, for those who can't remember?
Well, they were doing the tragic but brave Crip stories. You know, it was all about, you know, the sort of sad disabled person that managed to sort of, you know, lift an arm or do something equally uninteresting. And it was...
It was all the little violins playing, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
People were seen as weak and vulnerable and pathetic.
It was all of it. Yeah. All of it. Okay. It was... And we got together a demo within a few days because we were contacted by a group of young disabled people over in Ealing. And it's just that I guess we were known for just being around and doing stuff when it was needed. And so me and somebody called Alan Holdsworth, we were contacted and asked if there was anything we could do about this. So we put together an impromptu demo in 1990. We got about 50 or 60 people to that. And we showed that there was a real fury at the way that telethons not only took over the airwaves, but really, really sort of made disabled people look appalling.
So you were picketing outside or protesting outside ITV studios?
In Upper Ground, yeah, in central London on the South Bank.
And how did ITV react?
I mean, well,
I presume tear gas wasn't fired, but I mean, how did they respond?
They sort of patronised us, really. What was interesting about the early demos is the police didn't know what to do with us. So there was a little bit of, you know, they can't do that much harm. Let's pat them on the head and let them get on with it. And what it didn't prepare them for was that 2 years later, when the next telethon was on air, we were much, much better prepared. And we got in there, we started organising early, and we got 1,000 people.
And 1,000 people can obviously make a sizable difference. But wasn't your protest kind of slightly... the counterweight against it was that Telethon raised a lot of money, didn't it?
No. I mean, that's one of the big mythologies about TV fundraising, is it doesn't raise any more money than charity raises generally in any 1 year. There's an organisation called Intelligent Giving that's actually showed that all these sort of jamborees can often do more harm than good. And, you know, I think maybe Comic Relief is the one exception to that because they've taken a more political stance.
And Telethon never did come back then after this?
No, we destroyed it in 1992. It never came back after 1992. They got such... Because we were organised well ahead of time, we started organising in about the March for a July telethon. we got airtime. We were on the news, you know, mainstream news. In fact, I mean, it was an exciting time to be around and be a disabled campaigner because we, you know, there was interest, there was press interest. We had ITV and BBC News covering the protest. We had newspapers covering the protest and what we were protesting about. We had articles, front page pictures. We had all those things. See, one of the things that I think has gone really pear-shaped is the press just doesn't give us stuff about disabled people anymore.
Well, we'll be talking more with Barbara about this in a lot more detail, about those protest days again a little later, so stay tuned for that. But you'll be with us throughout the show and you'll be chipping in along the way, Barbara, I hope.
I'll do that.
Excellent. I just want to quickly introduce Leslie at this point. She's on the line from her home somewhere up north. Hello, Leslie.
Hi there.
Now, we should say Leslie isn't your real name. Leslie is a mum we mentioned earlier. She's adopted a 17-month-old little girl who today we're going to call Rachel, which is also not her real name. And Leslie, you want to remain anonymous to protect her, is that right?
Yeah, we're too easy to identify anywhere in the country, so yeah.
And is she there with you now?
Yep, you can probably hear her nice noisy breathing on my knee right now.
Great. Now, we'll be hearing your story after our next feature, which is Ouch News. Welcome to Ouch News, where we recruit news correspondents from the Ouch listenership who can bring us passion and knowledge from their corner of the disability world. We have one of our citizen journalists on the line with breaking news. Live from Sherborne in Dorset, it's Liz Hodges. Liz, you're new to the show, so tell us what you're the correspondent for.
Hi, Kate. I'm your OT, or occupational therapy correspondent.
Lovely. Now, Liz, you're an OT yourself and a disabled one, in fact. So for those of us around who don't know what an OT is, and that includes Rob, who's sitting next to me, had never heard of one before, surprisingly.
You have to out me every time about my ignorance.
Yeah, yeah. What can I say? So, Liz, can you just tell us what an OT is, and are there many disabled ones around?
OK, well, sure. This is the dreaded question for us OTs because it's really hard to explain what we do succinctly. But essentially, I work with disabled people, whether that's physical health problem, mental health problem, or people who have a learning disability, in order to help them achieve what they want to achieve in their life. And that can be through such a huge variety of different ways that I can help them. But that's a kind of really brief explanation.
Nice. That was nice and succinct. I think you did well there. So what's the latest OT news then, Liz? I gather your clients are whinging a lot about how rubbish equipment looks.
Yes. I frequently find that my clients are saying to me just how boring it is, how it all looks the same. It's kind of NHS standard issue. It's grey, it's utilitarian, and it just looks ugly.
So what kind of equipment are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, the whole range of equipment tends to be quite drab. Everything from crutches, walking frames, walking sticks, to things like toilet frames or any piece of equipment that we tend to give out. None of it looks exciting.
I always imagine them being in either white or gunmetal grey. I mean, is it just a case of making your home look like a hospital wing?
Yes, that's exactly it. You know, I get lots of my clients saying to me, I just don't want my house to look like a disability showroom, or this is just going to tell everyone that I'm disabled. And, you know, not everybody has an overt condition that people can see, and some people might want to be more discreet about that. But that's really hard with some of the equipment that we give out.
I can definitely relate to that because I remember my mum and dad had to put some bars on the walls to help me get in up to my front door at my mum and dad's house. And I always used to tell people that they were there for my grandma rather than for me because they just looked so rubbish.
Well, did you want a sort of Hello Kitty version of that?
Yeah, time? I wanted like purple and blue striped. Thank you very much. Now, Liz, you must deal with a lot of newly disabled people, especially for younger people, I guess. Maybe I'm generalising here, but is the equipment a bit of a culture shock for them?
Definitely. And I think you hit the nail on the head with what you just said. I mean, so much of it just looks like it's been designed for old people. You know, stair lifts often come with sort of nice beige seat covers or a nice peach or something. There's
yeah,
no bright colours or anything.
Yep.
And I have to be really mindful because I often will see people when they're just at the beginning maybe of having been diagnosed with a condition or having a sort of deterioration in symptoms. And, you know, I have to be so careful not to go in there and just give them all of the possible equipment that might help them all at once, because sometimes it just acts as a reminder of the things that you now can't do.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for bringing us your news, Liz. I think it's now time for you to sign off.
I've been Liz Hodge, your OT correspondent, reporting for Ouch News.
And we have more breaking news. It's Wendy Morell, our assistant animals correspondent, for
again?
A quite staggering
again?
Fourth time around. An old hand. Yeah, so we had no idea that
knew?
There was so much assistant animal news until we met you, Wendy. So what I'm going to... Are you there, by the way, Wendy? Hello.
I am. Hello.
Oh, good. Hello. So if your dog attacks an assistant dog, then you might be in for a big surprise, so says a new law. Fill us in on this.
May the 13th was really exciting in the world of assistance dogs because the Antisocial Behaviour Crime and Policing Act 2014 came into being.
And what is this new law? What does it mean in practical terms?
Essentially, where previously the Control of Dogs Act said that in terms of keeping your dog under proper control, you could only really be prosecuted if your dog injured a person. And now everywhere in that law where it says if a dog injures any person, it has been amended to allow the insertion or assistance dog. So that means that if you have an unruly dog and it attacks an assistance dog, you are liable to prosecution with a maximum possible penalty of 3 years imprisonment. And that will be even if the assistance dog is injured as opposed to dying.
So we always hear every year that attacks on assistance dogs are always going up. I mean, is this actually the case or is it just that the stories are getting reported more?
I think it's a bit of both because, you know, there is an increase in attacks. I've heard of two in the past 2 weeks. One was an assistance dog that was just free running in the park and was attacked by two Staffordshire Bull Terriers. And another one was a hearing dog that the lady was on her way home from work and the dog was in its jacket and on the lead and suddenly a dog literally came from nowhere and attacked her dog quite badly.
Were these fatal?
No. But certainly nasty enough to cause a lot of problems for the individuals concerned because unexpected veterinary treatment, obviously distress to the person who's witnessed the attack to the dog, distress to the dog then has to be temperamentally reassessed to check that it's not...
But do these laws still apply if the assistance dog bites back and it actually turns into a brawl rather than a full-on, you know, one-sided attack?
Well, do you know what? I've in sort of 14 years in the assistance dog movement, I've only ever heard of one dog retaliating in any way because they are specially chosen for their temperament, and often they would flee rather than fight back.
They are trained to be pacifists. They smoke a peace pipe.
Well, they're born pacifists. That's why they're chosen, really, and that's the problem because they really don't have the wherewithal to defend themselves, and that is the problem, particularly, you know, dogs that have been bred by assistance dog programs, you know, they're chosen when they're sort of 6, 7, 8 weeks old for their temperament. And so it is really difficult for the assistance dog partner because they know that their dog isn't going to be able to defend itself. And in the case of visually impaired or blind people, they can't even see the dog coming. Mm. With regard to somebody who's hearing impaired or deaf, they can't hear the dog coming. And somebody who's mobility impaired, really, they can't get out of the way quick enough either. So
to training your assistance dog to be a little bit more aggressive is just not going to be possible, is it?
It's an absolute no-no, really, because if an assistance dog were to bite in any sort of way, shape or form, it would probably go back to the program in the first instance for a behavioural reassessment. But if it did turn out that the dog had become aggressive, then it probably would be retired.
Well, thank you for bringing us your news, Wendy. It is now, for the fourth time in succession, it is time for you to sign off, please.
Thank you. I've been Wendy Morell, Assistant Animals Correspondent, reporting for Ouch News.
And will Wendy make it to 5 months in a row? Well, tune in next month to find out. If you have an area of interest within disability and want to be a correspondent, keeping us all up to date with the latest chat in your part of the community, then email ouch@bbc.co.uk or tweet @BBCOuch. How's your news? We want your news.
Yes, we do. And news us as soon as you can. So far we have, remember, a religious correspondent, an assistance animals correspondent, a TV correspondent, a fashion correspondent, a cures correspondent, an OT correspondent, a prosthetics correspondent, and we've got a few others waiting in the wings. So if you've already been on, then don't be shy. Please keep us up to date with your specialist knowledge.
Can I just say a word about Liz? She's my kind of OT. I had to sack an OT a few years ago. I just had really traumatic surgery in hospital, and I had this stupid bossy woman coming round, like, shouting at me and telling me what to do. And she really didn't pick the right person to do that to. But she's right about the equipment. It is hideous, and we really need to have a big change about what it looks like.
I completely agree. Leslie, what do you think? Have you had to have lots of adaptions made in your house that you really dislike?
Actually, really not. I have got a very adapted home, and I use a lot of specialist supportive disability equipment, and there's pretty much none of it that I really dislike the look of.
That's quite lucky.
I've got a very nice armchair that I chose the upholstery for. The hoist's a hoist. Nothing wrong with that. I like my power chairs.
Nice. Have you got a nice colour of power chair?
Yep. Black. Shiny blue metalwork.
Ooh, nice blue. I went for purple. I'm thinking about putting some polka dots on it, though. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad idea? Good idea, bad
idea. Isn't
this
like having a tattoo?
I think that's a pretty personal decision.
That's what I'm thinking. That's exactly what I'm thinking. This is a long-term investment. Will polka dots on the chair annoy me in a couple of years? Anyway, Leslie, let's turn our attention to you properly now. So Leslie adopted 17-month-old Rachel, a disabled child with complex needs, and has had her for about 8 weeks now. We hear adoption is a difficult process with multiple reasons why you may be rejected as a potential parent. But this didn't stop Leslie, who felt strongly she had the ability and love to adopt. Leslie is 28 and believes she's the first person to adopt who's disabled, who uses personal assistance for her own care purposes, and who is single. Many would think that there's already plenty of room for rejection or discrimination, but let's also add in that she's gay, Jewish, and, in her own words, not entirely Caucasian. Now, wow, Leslie, I think you might be the most minority person we've ever had on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about Rachel? What's she like?
Rachel is now 17 months, so she was 15 months old when she came home. She is a very easygoing, smiley little girl who has a severe physical impairment and visual impairment, as well as a few other bits and pieces. When I received her profile, unlike other children, where it says about their interests, what they like, what sort of things make them smile, whatever, Rachel's was a list of medical needs with nothing really to say anything about what she's like as a person. And so it's been a bit of a voyage of discovery since she's come home for me to get to know her, because I was starting with nothing. And what I've found is that she's a cheeky, nosy, perky, fantastic little girl who is also severely multiply impaired.
And is that who we can hear gurgling away in the background there?
Yes, indeed, that's Rachel's breathing. That's about as quiet as her breathing ever gets.
And is she chatty? Is she, what's she into?
She absolutely loves our cats and gets massively hysterically excited whenever there's a cat within her sort of field of vision.
Great.
She plays a lot. She likes a lot of the usual sort of baby games and stuff.
So what made you decide to choose a child who had these additional needs?
I grew up around other disabled kids. Although I benefited from an inclusive education and was not discriminated against as a child, particularly because I was minimally impaired as a young child. I grew up around other disabled kids, and this then sort of merged seamlessly into helping look after disabled children as I moved into adulthood. I did bits and pieces supporting my friends as a child and then moved into looking after kids. So actually the majority of my experience caring for children is caring for disabled children. So just for starters, that's what I'm more used to, is looking after disabled kids. But also I spent a period living in a nursing home a few years ago when my housing needs meant that my local authority were not able to accommodate me for a period of time. And while I was living in that nursing home, which had a young adult unit, a lad arrived who'd just turned 19 and had therefore, as was then, just aged out of the foster care system. They dump kids at 19 years old if they're disabled, I think even younger if they're not. And so he turned 19 and was promptly dumped in a nursing home. I realised then, having already been thinking about becoming a parent and realising for other reasons that adoption was likely to be the best way for me to become a parent, that disabled children who aren't adopted will land straight in institutions.
So when you saw Rachel, you thought, I don't want this to happen to her. Is that what made you do
that
it?
That was not so much for Rachel as an individual child, but in the general idea that I could parent a disabled child and achieve as part of that, that at least one child more would not end up in an institution.
Now, is it right that you originally wanted to become a foster parent rather than an adoptive parent?
That's right, yes. I initially mistakenly thought that being a foster carer would work better for me. Now, as I've understood the whole system better, it's become clear that that's not the case, and that actually it's being a foster carer is an immensely difficult job that I'm not particularly well cut out for. But I didn't know that at the time. And I got quite a long way into the sort of early process of applying with an organisation that specialises in finding foster carers and adoptive parents for disabled kids. And they were very, very positive about the idea of having me as a foster carer, until their board of directors realised that there was a very high chance that local authorities would discriminate against me as a foster carer and would not want to place children with me for foster care, and therefore that there was a risk that the charity would invest a huge amount of money training me as a foster carer and then be unable to use me if no local authority would place children with me.
So you thought it would be easier to foster and not do the kind of long-term commitment, yeah, but in the end it turned out the opposite way around.
Yes, I thought that the safety net for children of remaining in the foster care system meant that I didn't have to worry, for example, about my own long-term health, which at the time I believed that I didn't have a great long-term prognosis. That this is several years ago, and that's now also turned out not to be the case.
And then you did decide to adopt in the end. What made you change your mind?
After the sort of foster care application came to an end, I'd pretty much given up, but a few of my friends knew that I'd been interested. I got a text one day saying, "Were you still interested in fostering or adoption? Because I've heard about this little boy." That became the early stages of a specific application to be considered as a potential foster or, as it turned out, adoptive parent for that child in particular. That didn't work out in the end, I believe for discriminatory reasons, although I will never be able to investigate or prove that.
I mean,
but after that ended, I had by then really become attached to the idea that I could be a parent by adoption. And it was a very nasty shock when it ended. And I was then, by the same friends that had told me about this little kid in the first place, encouraged very strongly to get straight back on the bike in March last year.
So it's taken about a year to get through that process then. Was it quite tough to get approved?
Actually, no. It's been an incredibly positive experience for me. I was lucky to be assigned a social worker who had recently been involved in placing for adoption a child with a family where one parent is a PA user. So that social worker obviously immediately understood the basics of what being a PA using parent would mean, which is always a good start, you know. And she was incredibly positive about me as a potential parent and could see very quickly that it could work. And that so that turned very quickly into a formal application.
So to cut a long story short, I know that in November last year you finally got your parental passport, shall we say, and then you went to something which to me sounds in equal parts fascinating and slightly horrifying, called an Adoption Exchange Day. So can you tell me a little bit about this?
That's right. Exchange days are when groups of local authorities who work together to find parents for children that need them and children for parents that need them get together to share all the profiles of all the kids and all the prospective parents that they've got. Each local authority will attend with a load of profiles, A5 leaflets or similar, and big blown-up photographs of their children and of the prospective families. And
so it sounds like a kind of trade fair almost. This seems a little bit distasteful. You're treating children who need to be adopted and you're selling them in the way that you'd sell, I don't know, double glazing.
Pretty much. Although I must in fairness point out that the parents get exactly the same treatment. So this space is, you know, each local authority has a table with the profiles on it, staffed by one of their social workers, and roaming around are adoptive parents with their own social workers looking at children's profiles and children's social workers looking at all the parents' profiles.
OK, so there's lots of glossy photos, there's lots of social workers giving you the hard sell, this child is fantastic, it's a perfect addition to your home. You know, it does sound like a furniture sale. So how was Rachel being sold, shall we say? I hate to use that phrase, but what was the promotional material for Rachel?
Really,
right?
Started us on the path that made me realise that Rachel might be going to be my child was that she was being sold, advertised, for want of a better word, very badly. They'd used a tiny black and white photograph of her, the size of a passport photo, nothing else, which showed her aged perhaps 6 months, so it's an old photograph, fast asleep with a tube in her nose. So nothing of her personality or her sparkle was shown at all.
So why was such little effort made to, like you say, advertise her compared to the other children?
I never will. I got angry on her behalf. You know, this child I don't know whose photo I've only seen once. I got cross.
And so that was it seems like it's quite a strange emotion to make you want to adopt a child. Usually it's some sort of instant love or bond, but it was anger that actually got you close to Rachel.
It is a bond, though. If you're feeling cross on someone's behalf, if you're angry on a child's behalf, then that's a degree of sort of parental defensiveness that I think doesn't often happen very, very early on.
So let's fast forward to when you actually first met her, Rachel, we're talking about. What tell me what she was like. What was the first encounter like? Where did it take place? And
I met her for the first time at her then foster carer's home, which was out in the middle of the countryside, a very, very long way from where I live. When I arrived, she was crying in the next room, and they eventually brought her through and just kind of plonked her on my lap. I should add that adoptive parents don't normally meet children before the process of matching child and parent has been completed. This was a bit of a one-off and probably shouldn't really have happened. And at that point, this is now a good 4 months ago, Rachel was silent and passive. She lay in my arms and looked up at me. She barely moved and she didn't make a sound, didn't smile, didn't do anything really.
And how did that make you feel? Was it what you were expecting?
From the profile that I'd read of her, it was within what had been described in the profile.
And was there that instant bond, that instant maternal love? You know, did you feel that the moment that she was, like you say, plonked in your lap?
I did. I'd already, the thing of getting angry on her behalf had already happened again by that point. Because she'd been left crying in this other room while all the adults talked, because her social workers were there as well. And I sat there getting more and more furious that this baby was crying in the other room. And I was sat there listening to her, and I couldn't do anything to make it better. I couldn't even get into the room that she was in.
So this was the first time you actually felt, I can actually now do something with this anger. I can turn this into something positive and
I think
loving.
It had probably already started by that point, that sensation of this really could be my child. It's very weird with adoption because you're looking at profiles of children and asking yourself, is this my child that I'm now looking at? And you might go through that process with 10 or 15 children's profiles.
So let's quickly, before we finish, I'd love to talk about this a little bit further. But very quickly, Rachel's with you now. We can hear her. We've been hearing her throughout this conversation. She seems very, very calm and happy. So what is it that you do, and what do your personal assistants do? How is the work of being a mother split?
Right. Well, I'm her mum and they're not. So the work of being a mum is my job. They support me and I care for her, basically. This will not remain so straightforwardly the case as she grows up, because she will herself need personal assistance support as a young person when she's bigger. But at the moment, the nappies, the feeds, the medications, the waking up in the night is all mine. But my PA's jobs, in addition to what they were doing before, now include rather a lot of fetching nappies, nappy bags, syringes, retrieving dropped toys, almost infinite loops of picking up slippers that Rachel's levered off on the edge of a buggy, as well as all the stuff that they were already doing to support me and meet my needs of just sort of generic.
Well, I know Barbara.
PA,
I'm just going to bring Barbara in for a second. I know you have a daughter who's an adult now. I mean, does Leslie's stories here ring any bells for you as somebody who brought up a daughter as a disabled woman yourself?
Oh yeah. There's a lot of things I recognise. I mean, my daughter was a non-disabled child, but it was interesting because she figured out quite quickly the stuff I couldn't do, even when she was a few months old. So she used to cling on to me. You know, like most babies are just dead weight, they're just idle. They won't do anything, for goodness sake. And so she figured out that if she wanted to be picked up, she'd have to hold on a bit, give me a hand.
Rachel does that as well, yeah. Actually, it's great. She'll really hang on. Once I put her up on my shoulder, I can let go and she'll stay there.
Yeah, exactly. I think they figure it out really quickly, and what you'll get is just years of great stuff. I mean, I think being a parent is amazing. And it's still amazing, you know, even when they're older. And my one cooks for me now. I mean, you know, I couldn't ask for more. She's learning to be a chef and I just get the best food ever. So, you know, stick with it.
Good work. Good work training up a chef.
So it seems that Rachel's in absolutely no doubt whatsoever about who her mum is. You're taking on so much of the load yourself.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. But I mean, that's like no PA user's child ever wonders whether the PA is their parent. Yeah. And I don't think the fact that Rachel is being adopted is changing that, really, because there's the same clarity that I am the face and the voice and the hands that's here all the time.
Yeah.
Every time she wakes up, I am within the 3 or 4 feet of range where she can see me. Every single time.
Well, thank you, Leslie, for your story. It's absolutely fascinating.
It's an amazing story. Thank you so much.
Would you be able to hang around for our quiz, which we are coming
indeed
to shortly?
Yep.
Brilliant. Well, still to come.
Periphery woman, peripheral to you.
So that's Verity Smith with her song Periphery Woman, and we'll be playing that out at the end of the show.
Now, Barbara, back to you and Dan. Now, are Dan still around?
A lot of them are still around, but not in the same form. I think Dan sort of, he stopped being a distinct set of people probably a decade ago now.
So what do you think about the current campaigning then? What's replaced Dan, if anything?
Well, the nearest thing, I think, is Deepak, Disabled People Against the Cuts. And I really like what Deepak is doing. And, you know, but I just think there are a number of things that are different about sort of in the past campaigning and now. One of the things that I notice is that Deepak aren't getting the publicity. They're doing amazing actions and I'm not hearing it on the local news, I'm not hearing it on the national news, and I'm not reading about it much
in
the papers.
Why is that?
because I think they either need better press people or we need to, you know, sort of be there perhaps doing stuff that is going to catch the attention of the press more. One of the things that we were very clear about, it was a, you know, we took non-violent direct action, but the one thing that we did was that, you know, people like Martin Luther King and all the people that were sort of them from the Black Civil Rights Movement, everybody said that you've got to get yourself noticed. There's no point in doing any of this if people don't know you're doing it. And so you've got to be very public, you've got to be very daring, and you've got to get the press on your side.
So a more well-oiled PR machine could be what they need.
Yeah, well, I think they do. I think they need to make their contacts in the press, and I think they need to, you know, get in the habit. I don't know what they do at the moment, and maybe I need to be talking to them, but they need to get much better acquainted with how to get their stuff covered.
No, we don't have anyone from Deepak on the show to counter that, though. That's not to say we won't in the future. But just before we move on, my feeling about this always personally is that it always seems very strange to me that you know, these kind of activist groups, they seem to be very into getting coverage in left-wing newspapers, but I always think a lot of the time you're preaching to the converted and actually getting coverage in the likes of The Telegraph and The Sun and The Mail, even yeah. though they're publications that you might not necessarily enjoy as a reader, they can often be much more powerful.
You need to get into the mainstream press, absolutely. You need your headlines in the papers that people read. You know, I've given quotes, even though they misquoted, to The Sun, The Mirror, the you know, the Red Tops. I've done all of that, and I've even been to the Sky Studios, you know, with gritted teeth to give an interview because that's what I had to do. And my job in Dan was to take care of the press and to train people up to give interviews.
Are your teeth gritted today?
No, actually, I'm quite chilled today. You're doing all right so far.
Thanks. We
You're making me
that.
Feel so well.
That's what we needed, just a little spoonful of validation to help goodness. The medicine go down.
So what was your favourite action? What got you kind of the biggest response, do you think?
I think we did so many. I mean, there was a time when Dan just took over my life completely, but I have one or two that kind of stick in my memory. I think the time I was arrested for the first time is probably going to be up there with most of them.
And actually, big moment in your life, your first arrest.
My first arrest, I know. You can forget that. And it was in Leeds on a demonstration against children in need. But I'll tell you about the best demo we did in Leeds because it's still the one I remember. And it involved a very sort of well-respected and well-known BBC personality of the time, Jimmy Savile. And I don't know if I'm allowed to even say that name anymore without the walls crumbling. But
there's lots of nervous looks in the control room, I can tell you that for sure.
Well, let me tell you, Jimmy Savile climbed over me. And when we were picketing, disabled people in Leeds were furious because they got together some money to put in a garden for the disabled on the railway station at the end of one of the platforms. So disabled people are saying, none of the trains are accessible. What's the point of a garden, you know, so we can sit and look at the inaccessible trains? And they said, oh, yeah, it'll be scented. What, of diesel? But anyway,
you could have a little Thomas the Tank Engine track going around the garden, I suppose. You've got a little toy children's
Yeah, there's
railway.
Your compensation.
There's your compensation.
I heard you, didn't you shut down a cinema or occupy a cinema
or
something?
Oh, yeah, no, that was a good one. That was one that, you see, what we were good at doing is we had a big national campaigns, but we were also very responsive to local issues. And we went all over the country with those. I mean, I did feel a bit like...
So what happened with the cinema?
There was a guy called Andy Gill, who was a big part of Dan. And he was working with young disabled people. He was running a regular youth group in a youth centre in Holloway Road in North London. And they used to have this outing once a month to the Holloway Road Odeon. And one week they turned up and the manager, that was a new manager and who didn't know them, and said, too many wheelchair users, you're a fire risk, you're not coming in. And I mean, completely humiliated them, you know, in front of other customers and other staff. So they said, we're not having this, contacted us, because by that time we were kind of known as people who could get things moving. Me and Alan Holdsworth, Andy, Sue Elsgood from Greenwich, quite a few core group of people. And So we called an action at the Holloway Odeon.
What did you do?
We just blocked the doors. I mean, that is what we were good at. We just got enough people there. We blocked the doors of the cinema. We always produced a really good flyer that explained to members of the public. And we did it on a Monday. And we just stopped people going into the cinema. Not one person crossed our picket line. And what we said to the cinema management is we had a series of demands that came from the young people. And we said, first of all, we want a public apology. Secondly, you've got to assure us this will never happen again. And thirdly, you've got to sort out your access facilities.
And did you get it?
Oh, yeah. Of course we got it. I mean, the one thing about Dan is we never took no for an answer. And one of our chants was, we're Dan, we'll be back, get used to it.
And what about the cafe? There was a cafe in front of a cafe?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a cafe in Camden Town. And they chucked out a couple of wheelchair users because they said they took too much space and it was their busy time coming up, so they'd have to leave. And then the proprietor put a wheelchair symbol with a red line through it, as in no entry for disabled people above the counter.
That's astonishing. How long ago was this?
It was pre-DDA. They wouldn't get away with it now, but it was in the early 1990s.
So what did you do?
We decided that we were quite inventive with our actions. So we decided that if disabled people can go into this cafe, then they could come and eat with us outside the cafe. And we bought a table and we bought a picnic and we had some nice wine and, you know, just generally we put the table across the doorway to the cafe and said to people, if you want anything to eat, we'll sort you out.
Regardless
don't go
of
in
the
there.
Disability element, it just sounds like a better cafe.
Oh, it was.
Well, you had an alcohol licence for a start.
It was just such a laugh. I mean, the thing is, we had a lot of humour about the actions that we took. I mean, that cafe lost all its business on that day. People understood why they wouldn't go in. And they also said that they were taught to the proprietor if they did go in again, he had to take down his sign. He had to apologise to the people and promise never to do it again. And, you know, and the other thing is we made sure we got public statements and we got everything in writing. We didn't believe it if just people told us, you know, we got it all out there in the open. And, you know, it was a good, fun action and everybody really enjoyed doing it.
What would happen today if a cafe owner put a wheelchair with a red line through it?
Well, somebody could take them to court in a heartbeat because, you know, it's all of that is now unlawful under the Equality Act, and then prior to the Equality Act, the Disability Discrimination Act.
Let me bring in Leslie for a second. Have you done any similar kind of activist work, like Barbara?
Well, I mean, yeah, for a start, I'm a Danner as well.
A fellow Danner, we didn't realise.
Hello, fellow Danner.
Dan Lovin.
I'm a generation younger, so I missed out on the
lot. Oh, everybody's a generation younger than me.
So as a junior Danner, yeah. I presume you get a special badge for that. What have you been doing then in terms of protest work?
My first really big Dan action was up in Manchester. We went to visit the... DRC, as it was then.
The Disability Rights Commission?
Yeah, Disability Rights.
What did you do? Did you get chaining yourself to things? Did you throw yourself in front of things? Did you open a cafe?
More or less broke into their locked offices, which were up a tower block up above a shopping centre in central Manchester, and proceeded to occupy it for some hours while we waited for their chief exec to miraculously become available to talk to us, as they always do tend to.
Now, obviously, we can't condone or encourage any of these kinds of actions, but...
I can. I'm not one of you lot. I can condone and encourage
and
go
for
it.
Me and Kate can't.
Rob and I are sitting on the lovely BBC fence here.
And can I ask, do you find people signing online petitions, do you think that that's effective?
I think it can be effective for very, very specific things. I mean, I've changed a few, you know, I've signed a few change.org petitions myself. But I do think that, yeah, it's only one tiny, tiny scrap of activity that takes 10 seconds. And I think we need to be doing a lot more. And, you know, I keep thinking, I know that I've sort of been there and done it, but I'm kind of always on the verge of saying, I want to get back out there. And I mean, people are back out there. I saw a photograph of some of the old timers in a Deepak action this week. But again, the Deepak action got no publicity. It was a great action. They blockaded the DWP protesting about the way in which the Independent Living Fund is being withdrawn. And that again, that is one of the best targeted and most effective uses of government money.
But how many people were actually at that protest?
Are the participation
about
levels 100, as high?
I think.
So that's not nearly as high as the 1,000 strong you had for telethon 20 years ago.
It's not, but you know what? There was months of organisation to get to that telethon 1,000 strong. And what I would say, it was one of the most memorable and amazing demonstrations. And Mike Oliver, who's kind of, you know, one of the greats of disability politics and, you know, has written books about the social model and stuff. But he was on that demo and he said that this is the only place you can feel proud as a disabled person today, you know, because of the junk that was being pumped out over the airwaves. And we were doing our own party on the streets outside with, you know, people like Frank Bruno having a go, you know, Chris Tarrant. I mean, I can name names.
But I wish I'd been there.
Oh, I wish you had, but you might not have been born. So that would have been
Quite that young, but
almost.
I would have been in primary school. You would have been
in... No, we're looking at 1992. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your stories. And I think it's time... Now that we moved on to our quiz.
Indeed, we liked it so much in April that we've brought it back. A little quiz to end the show. So what have you remembered from disability news in the last month? So I'm going to let... Kate, why don't you ask a question?
Okay, so our first question of the day to you, Barbara, and to you, Leslie, who I hope is still on the line with us.
Yep.
Which disability has Oscar Pistorius's defence team introduced as a factor that they believe should be an important consideration at his murder trial?
Anxiety.
Oh, what was that, Leslie? Sorry?
Anxiety.
Anxiety. I think, what do we have? A bing, bing, bing for a right answer, Rob?
What can I bing? How about...
That terrible sound of the water bottle means yes. Barbara, do you know a bit more about this?
No, I was going to guess Asperger's on the basis that, you know, it usually is called into somewhere.
Well, Leslie has got that one right. He apparently has had an anxiety around violence due to an unstable childhood, and since the amputation of his legs, a psychiatrist told the court on day 29 of the trial. The BBC's Andrew Wooding said that the defence has always said his disability and vulnerability would play a part in the trial, but the prosecutor is focusing on how Pistorius seems to be moving his plea away from self-defence to something else. Pistorius stands accused of murdering his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp on February the 14th of last year. We now know that Oscar will be sent away for psychiatric evaluation within the next few weeks, presumably to see if this claim of anxiety disorder will indeed stand up.
Another question. Scope have launched a TV campaign this month which aims to get a conversation going about disability faux pas that the general public are reportedly worried about making. Now, can you tell me what this campaign is called?
I've seen Barbara already roll her eyes. I'm
well, I'm
in the
thinking
Godot here.
Scope on the ball as usual. Yawn.
I quite liked it.
And for those of you listening to this as a podcast, which is everyone, everyone is rolling their eyes. It's essentially called End the Awkward. It's a series of TV and web videos fronted by Alex Brooker, old friend of ours on the show, and also the presenter of The Last Leg. And he's highlighting awkward situations like how do you shake hands with someone who has their right arm missing and things like that. Apparently in a Scope survey, 66% of people say they fear saying the wrong thing in front of a disabled person. And another recent ad campaign you might have seen on the tube is Sitting is the New Smoking, which is, I would imagine, a bit of a smack in the face to wheelchair users.
Yeah, there's also
and
one
lazy
from,
people like me.
From a big brand that is called Sitting is the New Enemy. And I just think, oh,
what does
dear,
that mean?
I have no idea. But I quite like this Scope thing because I think there is a lot of awkwardness around disability. And at least this is getting people talking about it and thinking about it, and also, you know, not everyone knows how to approach somebody who does have one hand or whatever. I can see Barbara completely disagrees with me.
Look, in my day job, I'm a disability equality trainer, and one of the things, it's not fashionable to talk about equality anymore. Now, you know, now we're all talking about unconscious bias and all that stuff. You know, people know. If people want to know disabled people, go out and meet them. You know, you don't need an ad campaign by Scope to tell somebody whether or not they should shake hands with somebody who hasn't got a hand. I mean, you know, give me a break. We just need to focus on what is really going on, which is the hammering disabled people are getting by the benefit system, by the government cuts. And we need to look at why disabled people, since the introduction of the DDA, are still much more likely to be unemployed.
But I mean, there is always an awkwardness that goes around, that comes along with disability. I mean, Leslie, surely you've had some of those awkward situations, haven't you?
Well, yeah, of course. But I think that making a big fuss about it actually emphasises any differences, and it sort of legitimises people thinking that we're a bit weird and we need to be treated specially.
Does that mean that we shouldn't talk about it at all then? We shouldn't talk about the awkwardness?
We should just get on with existing and interacting with each other and, you know, living our lives in this big old world we live in.
Well, I know it seems a little bit gauche and cheesy to us, but I know my feeling is that it can potentially have a positive impact. I mean, just for example, I mean, I have a visual impairment, but until I started presenting this show, I really didn't have any contact with disability world whatsoever. And for younger listeners or more recent listeners, may not know that the original presenter of the Ouch show was a fellow called Matt Fraser, who you might have seen at the closing ceremony of the Paralympics playing the drums for Coldplay. And he's got thalidomide and has little...
He's too big for us now.
And when I first met him, I genuinely didn't know if I should shake his flipper or not. I really didn't know what the right thing to do was. And ultimately, there was a bit of awkward kind of backing and forward in between us until he sort of thrust the flipper forward. And I thought, well, OK. He calls it the flipper, by the way. These are his terms. And he did thrust his flipper forward and just said, go on, touch it, get on with it. And so I did. But, you know, he's an extremely provocative individual. And if it had been somebody else who had that similar condition, I think it would have been difficult, because ultimately Matt made it easy for me. I didn't really have to do anything.
I'm really not sure. Like,
what do you mean?
I find it hard to lift my hand enough to shake someone's hand sometimes as well. And I think those of us who shake hands differently, we all get very good at diving in there and showing the other person what to do.
I don't know. Sometimes I quite like it when I don't need to worry about that stuff because somebody knows it instinctively. You know, if I'm sat in my wheelchair and somebody bends down to talk to me, it drives me crazy. But if they've seen this advert, maybe they won't bend down and talk to me anymore. Is that not a good thing?
No, it's a complete distraction and diversion. It's got nothing to do with anything. Look, you're a disabled person. You're going to have to put up with crap in your life. I think the thing that we need to be working on is actually supporting disabled people in how to deal with
their
crap.
You'll be lucky if you see Kate in a wheelchair. It's like spotting a snow leopard. I've known her for over a year. Never seen her in a wheelchair once. And you thought my disability was marginal. Anyway, question, Kate.
Yeah, I'm just going to sit here being told off by the disability royalty in the studio. It's totally fine. Anyway, question. The next question, please. Next question. Originally hosted by Bob Monkhouse, which game show is set to return to ITV, but this time with Life's Too Short star Warwick Davis?
I think Rachel
knows the.
Did we hear Rachel
chiming in there for the answer?
I think Rachel may be sort of gently reaching the limit of her patience.
Well, well, she's done very well.
I'm presuming that it's a big don't know from you, Leslie.
Yeah. Nope. Sorry.
Okay. And Barbara.
I do know, but shall I tell you how I know?
Go on, tell everyone the secrets. Go on,
because they told me the answer by mistake.
Can I just clarify? Rob told her the answer during our pre-studio chat.
But I'm going to tell you the answer. It's Celebrity Squares, which was awful the first time round. So there's no need to watch it the second time round either. I wouldn't have thought.
Warwick Davis, of course, an old friend of the show, and we wish him all the best with his new venture. It's one apiece. Last question, deciding question for you both. So, in her later life, she became blind and then a wheelchair user. Author Sue Townsend sadly died this last month, aged 68. But what was the name of the angst-ridden teenage diarist she created? Who's going to shout out first?
Me.
Barbara.
Oh, it's Adrian Mole. I grew up with Adrian
Mole. It is
Mole.
Adrian Mole. Yeah, we had her on the show 4 years ago. And I should also point out, as a tribute, we have put up the interview me and Liz Carr did with her on our Audioboo channel. In it, she told us she thought about death quite a lot and she wanted Adrian to face death. And so she gave him prostate cancer in her most recent and what will, of course, now be considered the very last Adrian Mole book. So it's the end of the quiz and we have a winner.
We do. It's, I'm afraid, Leslie, you came a very close second, but today's winner is Barbara.
2-1.
Now I'm honoured.
Squeaky bum, but you made it.
So that's the end of the quiz, and so to the end of the show. Thank you, Barbara and Leslie, for being with us today. And thanks go to the Ouch team, Tom Hayden, Emma Tracy, and our studio manager, Joe Langdon. The producer was Damon Rose.
And music this month is by a blind dressage rider turned author and singer, Verity Smith. Verity's hopes of competing at London 2012 were dashed when the horse she was due to ride died of cancer, and she herself was also seriously injured in a car crash. Quite appalling run of bad luck.
Very bad luck, yeah. But now Verity is back in the saddle with a project to raise money for a new horse called Kit. Signed copies of her book, The Groper's Guide, and her album, La Verity, will be given to some of those who pledge money on her crowdsourced fundraising site. The book and the album are out this month. Cue Rob doing his DJ thing.
I'll try. From that album, this is Periphery Woman. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
I've known her for over a year. Never seen her in a wheelchair once.
Take me to a theme park.